The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled How to Overcome Depression, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Yaakov Nachmiel Ben Tzadok Shimon Olav HaShalom, Kobe Levy of Blessed Memory.
Ask any parent, what are the most important things that you want for your children? High on everyone's list will be the answer, I want my kids to be happy and well-adjusted. This nation was founded on the principle that happiness is one of man's basic rights. All men, in the words of the Declaration of Independence, are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. According to the Torah, however, happiness is not merely the wish of doting parents or rights that may or may not be exercised. Happiness is actually a mitzvah, a requirement. If you turn to the second page of your notes, we quote from the words of Maimonides, Rambam, in the beginning of Hilchos Deos, the laws regarding character. And according to Maimonides, moderation in life is one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, one of the commandments of the Torah. And we quote from the Rambam, if you look on your notes, the straight path of life is the golden mean or middle road of human behavior in all its manifestations. A person should not be manic or hilarious, nor should he be sad or mournful, but he should be happy his whole life with a calm demeanor and favorable countenance. This is part, as you'll read the Rambam, is part of the mitzvah, and you shall go in the path of God. It's not a specific requirement, but it's part of, it's subsumed in the general requirement of living a life of moderation. The Torah again alludes to the idea of the importance of joy in one's life in the next section, paragraph B here. And this is quoted from Deuteronomy chapter 28. This is verses 45 to 48. This is the covenant. This is the bris, the pact that God made with the Jewish people. In it, it contains the blessings and, unfortunately, the curses. What's remarkable is what we have in the underlined portion of this section, that the curses come not necessarily because the Jews have not fulfilled the mitzvahs, but they've done it begrudgingly. Because you serve not the Lord your God with joyfulness and gladness of heart. You did it, but you did it with a kvetch. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Olav HaShalom, one of the great Torah scholars of the last generation, commented on the fact that there are many people, hardworking people, who sacrificed very much to keep Torah, to keep Shabbos, and yet they didn't merit that their children should go in their ways. And one reason, he claimed, may have been a factor, was there's an old Jewish adage, "Seshver tzayne yid," you know, it's hard being Jewish. If you bring that home with you, and it becomes a burden, then your children figure, "Then what do I need it for?" And here we find in this paragraph the importance of not only doing it, but doing it with the right attitude. One of the great rabbis of the 18th century, Rav Aaron of Karlin, put it this way: Simcha, joy, is not expressly one of the 248 positive commandments. But with joy, one can attain the highest levels of spirituality. And depression is not one of the 365 negative commandments of the Torah. But because of depression, a person can sink so low that he can conceivably forsake the entire Torah. In other words, the issue of happiness and depression are very much part of the Torah. And the Torah, by the way, has much to say about it. But before we begin with the Torah's approach, it's important to ask ourselves the following questions. What is depression? What causes it? And how is it cured? To better understand this, let's start from this hypothetical case. Your friend walks over to you and tells you, "I'm depressed." What should the appropriate response be? Should you hear the person out and offer some words of encouragement or advice? Or should you refer the person to professional help? And what kind of professional help is appropriate? What confuses the matter is that the same phrase, quote, "I'm depressed," end quote, is used to describe two very different phenomena. On the one hand, the term depression is used to describe a temporary depressed or sad mood. Such feelings are quite normal and are an appropriate response to traumatic situations that affect the quality of our lives. The scripture states in Kohelis chapter 3, verse 4, there's a time to weep and there's a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. When these sad feelings are not just temporary, but become part of the person's basic continued mood, or keep on being triggered on a continual basis, often coupled with a sense of worthlessness and hopelessness, is a sign for a person to reassess his values and direction, perhaps to begin making major changes in his life. For such a person who always suffers from a depressed mood, words of encouragement by a close and trusted friend, guidance by a therapist, or even self-directed change and focus is frequently all that such a person needs. But the term depression is also used to describe an acute and often chronic illness. In this complete form, the person will experience not just sadness, but many of the following symptoms. To remember these symptoms, I want to use the letters A through M. A is for appetite change, either more typically a loss of appetite or less often an increase in appetite. B is bedtime. Sleep patterns are abnormal, with much more or much less sleep than usual. You toss and turn, but can't get to sleep. C is for crying, spontaneous and uncontrollable tears. D is for desire. You lose all interest in activities that always used to give you pleasure, including marital relations. E is for exhaustion. You're exhausted and have no energy. F is for failure. You feel worthless and just a miserable failure. G is for guilt. You harbor constant feelings of guilt. In your mind, you construe these sufferings of depression as a punishment and atonement for past misdemeanors or felonies. H is for hypersensitivity. Everything just gets on your nerves. I is for indecision. Just can't make decisions. Your judgment and mental abilities are impaired. You can't even concentrate. J is for jumpy. You're jumpy and restless. K is for kvetchy, excuse the Yiddishism. You feel sad and miserable, complaining. And finally, L is for living. Life is not worth living, and begin to think, I wish I would just wouldn't wake up in the morning. And M is for managing. You can't manage, and you look around, and you're wondering, how is the whole world able to manage and not me? This type of depression, with many of the symptoms I have enumerated, is a physical malfunction similar to diabetes or emphysema. There's something wrong with the normal function of the body. Luckily, in the case of depression, is usually completely curable. I have a whole section devoted to the medical aspects of depression, but because of the time constraints, and if we have time, we'll go back to it later. I'd like to skip this portion. And I'd like to go on to really the theme of this night's lecture. If a person has these symptoms, one should go see a doctor. But even if one is seeing a doctor, and of course one just feels the mood of depression, just feels sad, but isn't experiencing all the manifestations, it's important to have a different look on life. a different orientation on life. And truly, that orientation is really the major subject of tonight's lecture. I've divided this lecture into 10 sections. The beginning letters of each section spell out the word depression. And we've covered the first part of this section, the D, which refers to depression and the requirement, the mitzvah of the Torah, to remain in a state of even keel, to be constantly happy, and to do the important things in life with joy. The E of depression is exercise. Every medication your doctor is going to give you is going to have side effects. In fact, in the last section, on page 3, in the last section of section D, paragraph F, the Talmud makes the statement that every medication is beneficial for one problem and will create other problems. What we're trying to do is really to create a regimen that will be problem-free. Again, we quote from the Rambam in the beginning of section E, exercise. This is paragraph A. We said there's a mitzvah of being, of having a living a life of moderation. There's a mitzvah of being healthy. And as the Rambam says in the bottom of page 3, since having a healthful body without imperfection is part of, quote, the path of God, that which we're required to follow. For it is impossible to understand or have any knowledge of the Creator in a state of illness. It is therefore important and required that we remain healthy. One of the means of remaining healthy, of course, is exercise. The Rambam was not only one of the great experts of Jewish law and Talmud. In his time, he was one of the greatest medical authorities. And it's interesting to see what the Rambam wrote about the importance of exercise some 700 years ago. It's 800 years ago. Here in paragraph B, the most beneficial of all types of exercise, on top of page 4, is physical gymnastics, to the point that the soul becomes influenced and rejoices. We know today that exercise not only is healthy for your body and your heart, but it seems to release chemicals that are closely related to morphine. They're called endorphins or endogenous morphines. They put you in a better mood. When you exercise, you feel better. So the D, again, let's get to depression. D is depression. There's a mitzvah to be happy. E is exercise. P is pleasure. And here on page 4, quote from the Talmud, three things restore a man's good spirits: beautiful sounds, sights, and smells. It's important, especially if we're prone to feeling down, to create an environment that lifts up our spirits. Beautiful sounds or music, the sights, smells. We know there's whole study into how we are affected by lack of light or winter. It's called SAD, which is seasonal affected depression. We are affected by the light we have. That's why it may be important to travel south if it's really the Michigan winter is really getting to you. But it's important to know that there are things out there that can lift up your mood short of medication. So again, one is exercise. P is pleasure, pleasurable experiences. The Talmud refers, and then this is the next quote, about wine, about alcohol. But of course it warns about the problems of alcohol and the problems of moderation in alcohol. I brought this, and really for some people it is important, but for others it's poison. By the way, I read a very interesting study. And this was a study about the differences between Jews and non-Jews, of the difference in genders regarding depression. Generally, in any one population, women will have generally be twice as likely to be depressed as men. In a study that was made in England, though, they found that the rate of depression amongst Jewish men and women, this is from an Orthodox congregations in England, was roughly the same. And the researchers were wondering, why is this so? I mean, why is this that twice as many women in a general population are depressed, and there's equal numbers of men and women in this Jewish Orthodox population? What the researchers wanted to say, again, it's open to further research, is that alcoholism is generally very rare in the Orthodox community. The reason men tend to be less depressed than women is because they are drunk. They have other problems. And it isn't that they're, you know, everything is wonderful with them. It's just they have another outlet, and they have a whole set of other problems. In a culture that alcoholism is not part of that culture, you would tend to see equal numbers, which at least that's the theory of those researchers, and that's their conclusion. But again, E is for exercise, P is pleasure. Takes us now to R, which is religion. But ultimately, real pleasure is related to a sense of purpose. Pleasure without a purpose in life is an oxymoron and only continues to lead to depression. Because after one thrill or another thrill, eventually you have to go home and it starts all over again. Let me quote the words of the New Harvard Guide to Psychiatry. Quote, "Many who have worked closely with adolescents over the past decade have realized that the new sexual freedom has by no means led to greater pleasure, freedom, and openness, more meaningful relationships between the sexes, or exhilarating relief from stifling inhibitions. Clinical experience has shown that the new permissiveness has often led to empty relationships, feelings of self-contempt and worthlessness, an epidemic of venereal disease, and a rapid increase in unwanted pregnancies." And continues on to say, those people who went through the revolution of the 60s and the 70s, they describe pervasive feelings of guilt and haunting concerns that they were using others and being used as sexual objects. There's a consistent statistical correlation between mental well-being and a strong religious faith. Several studies have found that high levels of religious commitment correlate with lower levels of depression, lower levels of stress, and greater ability to cope with stress. That doesn't mean that all religious people are free from depression, nor does it mean that all people live a life without strong religious faith are doomed to misery. What it does mean, though, is that a person with strong faith is much more likely to lead a happier life than a person without it. Let me quote a sampling of these studies. A large 1972 study published in the Journal of Chronic Disease found that persons who did not attend religious services were 4 times as likely to commit suicide than were frequent attenders. Lack of religious service attendance has been found to be the single best predictor of suicide rates, better than unemployment. One study published in the Southern Medical Journal in 1980 found that 90% of alcoholics had already lost interest in religion in their youth. This compares to 48% of the control group of non-alcoholics that showed increased interest in adulthood. It says only 20% of this non-alcoholic group showed less religious interest in adulthood. Red Book magazine, of all places, conducted a massive survey of their readership, which was published in 1977. An analysis of their data found that, quote, very religious women report greater happiness and satisfaction with marital relations than either moderately religious or non-religious women, end quote. They were surprised also, let me tell you. One of the major problems that we face is for the last century, specialists in human and animal psychology, the most respected men of their fields, Freud, Adler, Skinner, Ellis, and their close disciples have preached a message that religion is a sickness in itself. If only man would be free of faith of God, he would be mentally healthy and happy. That is why their disciples, today's psychologists, carry their founders' prejudices. 93 to 95% of all Americans believe in God. A 1975 study published by the American Psychiatric Association reported that only 43% of psychiatrists believe in God. And a 1972 study of the American Psychological Association showed that a mere 1.1% were believers. Their belief in the uselessness or harm in religion and belief is reflected in the advice that they often give their clients and patients. David B. Larson, a former National Institute of Health psychiatrist, who has cataloged many of the new studies into the relationship between religion and mental health, writes, I quote, if a new health treatment were discovered that helped to reduce the rate of teenage suicide, prevent drug and alcohol abuse, improve treatment for depression, reduce recovery time from surgery, lower divorce rates, and enhance a sense of well-being, one would think that every physician in this country would be scrambling to try it. Yet what if critics denounced this treatment as harmful despite research findings that showed it to be effective more than 80% of the time? Which would you be more ready to believe, the assertions of the critics based on their opinions or the results of clinical trials based upon research? He, of course, was speaking about the effect of religious belief on mental health. The Taurus position concurs with this latest research. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, of blessed memory, one of the great scholars of the past generation, once commented that the increase in depression was due to the fact that people no longer prayed and cried to God. When you pray, not only is there a sense of well-being, there's a catharsis. You have someone to talk to. And it used to be, when Jews prayed, it wasn't just merely lip service, or they were listening to someone pray on their behalf. They were actually praying. They were crying. And one, we once played a snippet of Fiddler on the Roof in one of our talks. One of the very interesting things about Tevye, he's always talking to God. I know someone, she's a teacher in Northern California. She comes from an Orthodox home. She's always talking to God. And she was telling this to a non-Jewish colleague of her. And the colleague commented, you know, only Jews do that. You know, it's that, you know, it's a holdover of the... There's this closeness, like you're always talking. Prayer is a tremendous catharsis if we would only truly pray and not just open a book and just read words. I would like to conclude this section with the words of Carl Gustav Jung, one of the great pioneers of psychology. These words were written in 1932. Speaking about his patients, he said, there's not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. It is safe to say that every one of them fell ill because he had lost that which the living religions of every age have given their followers. And none of them has been really healed who did not regain his religious outlook. In the handouts, on page 4, we deal with the idea of joy in doing a mitzvah. You can read this on the bottom of page 4. But besides the actual joy, the feeling of you're doing something right, you're connecting to a higher power, there's something special to be said about the study of Torah. And on top of page 5, it's a fascinating quote. This is from the Talmud in Erev in 54. Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Chiya, remarked, "Come and see how the dispensation of mortals is not like that of the Holy One, blessed be He. In the dispensation of mortals, when a man administers a drug to a fellow, it may be beneficial to one limb, but injurious to another. This is the problem of side effects with medication. But the Holy One, blessed be He, it is not so. He gave the Torah to Israel, it is a drug of life for all his body, as it said, and it's a healing to all his flesh." Besides that which we've dealt with, the psychological component of religion, the feeling of well-being, the catharsis of prayer, there's something magical about the study of Torah. It connects one to the source of all life. And for Jews of all generations, that connection to Torah seems to have been a process of their general well-being and healing. And now it brings us to E, envy. One of the major problems of why we're not happy is because so many people have what we don't. As we quote, this is on page 5, in the first paragraph, paragraph A, where Elazar HaKapper says, "Envy, lust, and glory remove a man from this world." We're always trying, we're always moving, we're always so driven. The Talmud says, this is from the Midrash, says, "Ein odem meis v'chatzi tavosa biyodai." No person dies without fulfilling only half of his desires in life. We never just feel fulfilled. It's important to realize, and this is a basic tenet of Judaism, that God takes care of us. Each one of us has a special situation in life. None of us plays on a level playing field. And each one has their own unique set of challenges. And it's difficult in a sense to say that my life is better than your life, or your life is better than his or her life. It's like the story of the man who went into a suit store and says, "I want the best size." Well, there are no best sizes. Everyone has a different size. And therefore the topography of our life is very different from that of someone else's. It's not better, it's just different. On paragraph B here on page 5, we quote the Talmud in Yuma, in Yoma, in 38b. "No man can touch what is prepared for his fellow." You can't. What's bashert for you, you're going to get. And what's bashert, what's destined for someone else, you can't touch. So you're going to get yours. And referring to Tzoros, here on the bottom, this is on paragraph C on page 5, Rabbi Hanina further said, "No man bruises his finger here on earth unless it is so decreed against him in heaven." In essence, what we're saying here is that God is with us every step of our life. The trick is to look at our set of situations as a challenge, not just merely a cross to bear. I'd like to tell over the following story, which is related by Rav Noach Weinberg, the Dean of Eishet Torah. This was taken from an interview. He says, do you know, and I'm quoting the interview, do you know that Hashem, the God, has a sense of humor? I recall a boy who came to one of our beginners programs, who had just come from visiting the Kosel, the Western Wall, for the first time. This young man was not only non-religious, he was also quite anti-religious. He came from a completely secular American Jewish home, and he said he was turned off by all the religions he was exposed to here in Jerusalem. He had come to the Kosel thinking of just one more tourist attraction, nothing more than anything else. You know, how can you go back home and you say you didn't visit the Western Wall? So he says, by the wall, he went to the area where the people are davening, where they're praying. And the attendant insists that he put on one of those paper yarmulkes, you know, the paper skull caps. He had no choice and grudgingly put it on. Then he approaches the Kotel, approaches the Western Wall to look up close. All around him, men are davening, they're praying. Some are saying Tehillim psalms. Many are praying out loud. Some are swaying back and forth or shuffling. And he just can't take it. This is just too much for him. Too much religion. This is everywhere he goes, he's had it. He grabs the yarmulke off his head and throws it down to the ground in disgust. And then, as soon as he bares his head, one of the holy doves that flies around the Kosel drops down some business on top of his head. This is a hit. He looks to heaven and he thinks to himself, okay, you got me back. At that very moment, Rav Meir Shuster came over and asks him, he taps him on the thing, if he'd like to visit a yeshiva. He was afraid to say no. But the essence of the story is that God is with us. And if we look at it's a unique set of circumstances. Like, there's no best size. It takes the edge off much of the envy that we have in life. S is for sadness. As we quoted in the beginning of the lecture from Koheles, from Ecclesiastes, there's a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. And it's really important that we savor those moments of sadness just as we savor those moments of happiness. When a close one departs, it's important for us to have the feeling that something of our life is gone, not just to take Valium. It's very interesting to see the difference when one goes to a very traditional, an ultra-Orthodox home where they're commemorating the Shiva. They're sitting in mourning. And into a home, a Jewish home, which is less traditional. In a very traditional home, you really sense mourning. You really sense that people are sad. And the people that come aren't there to cheer up the person. They're there to create a sense of catharsis. Comforting is different than cheering up. Words of comfort are words that give a person hope to go on to the next day. A feeling that they're carrying on. If it's a parent that died, it's the comfort that the child is now carrying on the values and hopes and dreams of the departed. But sometimes when you go to a home which is much less traditional, you have a sense you're going to a carnival. No one wants to face death. Everyone is laughing and the joking. No one is, they're all afraid to say, you know, we are all going to die one day. It's all part of life. And it's important to feel sad. And it's important for the person who feels sad to share those feelings. Sadness has a very important part in our lives. But it should come and it goes. When we take it too much to heart, then it becomes an illness. And here we have, this is the quote at the bottom of the paragraph in the section A, you can read it yourself, about how much over-mourning is not healthy. A topic that I'm going to be touching upon next month's lecture is the idea of the afterlife. And I just want to quote to you part of that next month's lecture. And this is taken from, was a bestseller called Many Lives, Many Masters by Dr. Brian Weiss. Dr. Brian Weiss is a practicing psychiatrist. At the time he wrote the book, he was the head of the Department of Psychiatry in the University of in this Mount Sinai Hospital, I think it was connected to the University of Miami. He had a particular patient who he was unable to treat with drugs, with medication, and started hypnotic therapy on the patient. And under hypnosis, this patient recalled previous lives. I mean, that's the name of the book, Many Lives. In the process, and I don't, this is next month's lecture, but in the process, in this hypnotic state, this woman claimed that she was visited by the departed souls of two relatives of Dr. Weiss. This woman barely knew Dr. Weiss, only in a professional. She only had a professional relationship with Dr. Weiss. And I'm quoting from the book here. Your father is here. This woman is in her hypnotic state, and she claims that she sees these departed spirits. And your son, who is a small child. Your father says you will know him because his name is Avram. She was a Catholic girl, by the way. And his English name, I believe, was Alvin, and the name Avram he only used when he had an Aliyah Latera, when he was called up to the Sefer Torah. It was something that was rarely used. And your daughter was named after him. He gave the name Amy to his daughter after his father, Avram. Also, his death was due to his heart. Your son's heart was also important, for it was backward like a chicken's. He made a great sacrifice for you out of his love. His soul is very advanced. He goes on to say, his death satisfied his parents' debts. In other words, he came onto this earth for a short period of time and died. It was important for his parents to undergo this sadness. Also, he wanted to show you that medicine can only go so far, that its scope is very limited. Because of this incident, he originally planned to be an internist, and after his son died, and he saw the limits of medication, he decided to go into psychiatry. I just brought this snippet of the book that it really reinforces a very Jewish idea. The suffering that we have and the sadness that we have, that we should savor for the moment, is really part of God's plan. And in a certain sense, the idea of death is not permanent. Because death is part of life, and our consciousness survives bodily death. One of the ideas of why we have setbacks is that sometimes it's a wake-up call. Sometimes we have to be shooken up. We quoted before from Noah Weinberg. I'd like to make another quote, an interview from him. This is all quoted, but there's a new book that came, Einei Hashem, The Eyes of God, from Mayor Wickler, who quotes these interviews. Rabbi Weinberg tells the story of a certain young man who visited the yeshiva and told the rabbi he had no need of a yeshiva. Since he and God, and he held up his two fingers, are like this. In other words, his middle and second finger were just like. In the words of Rabbi Weinberg, quote, his name was Reuven. I told Reuven that I was very moved to be in the company of someone who was so close to God. There was a brief silence. Then I gently asked, how exactly did he know that he was so close to God? Oh, Rabbi, that's easy to explain, Reuven eagerly began. Like I said, God does miracles for me. Let me give you an example. My favorite hobby is riding my mountain bike all over the countryside back in the States. So one day I'm riding my bike down a quiet, narrow mountain road, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a speeding car comes up the hill, barreling around the curve, and starts heading straight at me. To my left is the solid rock of the mountain. To my right is a steep cliff with a low guardrail. And coming head-on is the speeding car. I have no choice but to veer off the road to my right. I try to stop, but I'm going too fast. My bike flies over the guardrail like a ski jump. I sail over the cliff and drop straight down about 50 feet. I'm in such a panic. I just yell, God, on my way down. My bike lands between two huge rocks and gets twisted like a pretzel, and I walk away with barely a scratch anywhere on my body. Now I ask you, Rabbi, wouldn't you call that a miracle? Doesn't that prove to you that me and God are like this? Again, holding up his middle finger. I told him that I cannot argue with him. That was a miracle if I ever heard one. To save him like that, God must surely love him, I added. Reuven, I said, I fully accept that it was God who saved your life that day in the country. But I'd like to ask you something else. Sure, Reuven said confidently. What would you like to know? Who do you think it was who threw you off that cliff in the first place? Reuven just stood there with his mouth open. Then I suggested to him that perhaps the very same God who saved him from the fall had brought the speeding car from around the bend. I went on to ask him why he thought that God would do such a thing. Why put his life in danger only to save him? Reuven just shook his head. Then I answered my own question. I told him that perhaps God was trying to get his attention. That maybe this was a wake-up call. I waited a moment and asked him if he wanted God to try again to get his attention. Reuven stayed to learn in our yeshiva. One of the problems that we have about sadness is very often it's hard to distinguish between the things that we should be sad about and the things we shouldn't. Of course, there are a death in the family. I mean, there are different traumas we know we should be sad about. Jewish law behooves us to be sad about these things. But there are other things that one is really not quite sure if in taking the whole set of experiences in life, is it really worthy of being sad? There was a wonderful little story about someone who came to a rabbi with many complaints. This was no good, and that's no good, and the other thing was no good. And the rabbi took out his pencil and walked over to the wall. It was a clear white wall. And he went over and made three marks on the wall. You know, one here, and one there, and one on the other. And he he went over to the man. And he says, you know, just walk, you know, take a few steps back. He says, what do you see? He says, Rabbi, I see three dots. What about the wall, the rabbi asked? There's a whole white wall. Of the whole wall, all you see is just three dots? In life, we tend just to see the dots. And it's very important to see the gestalt, you know, to see the whole picture. So it's true there are many things in life that we should be sad about, at least temporarily sad about. But there are other things that really need an evaluation. On top of page 6, I quote from the story of Esther, from the Megillus Esther. And this is the incident in the story that Haman walks from the outside of the palace. He has just been invited to the feast that Esther, the queen, is hosting, and only he, Haman, and Ahasuerus, the king, are the guests. He's on top of the world. And as he leaves, he sees Mordechai, his nemesis, who doesn't move a muscle, doesn't look on his side. He's a total non-entity in Mordechai's eyes. And he becomes enraged. He just has to hold himself back from doing something. He has to hold himself back. He comes home, and the first thing he does is, we have this in bold, and Haman told of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him and how he advanced him above the princes and servants of the king. In other words, and this is what the Gaon of Vilna in his commentary explains, when you're feeling down and out, it's a good time to make an inventory about your life. How does this incident compare to everything else that's happening to you? And it's just like the three dots on the wall. Once you see the wall, the dots, it's nicht so gefährlich. You could perhaps live with the dots. The next section is S of this depression, is sin. Again, we quoted before, and I have to quote again from the New Harvard Guide to Psychiatry. They're speaking about the breakdown of sexual mores. The disillusionment of late adolescents with the sphere of their lives, as well with drugs, has contributed to the recent religious preoccupation among youth, especially the trend towards traditional religious faith. Although the basic Judeo-Christian morality conflicts with their past behavior and current mores, they found the clear-cut boundaries it imposes less confusing than no boundaries at all, and more helpful in relating to members of the opposite sex as persons rather than sexual objects. In other words, when we break the bounds that we instinctively know are wrong, in the short term, we may have a good time. In the long term, we have a sense of worthlessness. Having values and boundaries and a commitment to uphold them seems to have an important ingredient in one's self-respect and one's overall happiness. Winston Churchill in 1940, after having been elected to the position of Prime Minister of Great Britain, said as part of his tribute to the defeated Neville Chamberlain, and I quote, "The only guide to a man is his conscience. The only shield to his memory is the rectitude and sincerity of his actions. It is very imprudent to walk through life without this shield, because we are often mocked by the failure of our hopes and the upsetting of our calculations. But with this shield, however the fates may play, we march always in the ranks of honor." If you're willing to sacrifice, if for your beliefs. It creates a sense of worth. Very often we lose when we make the sacrifice to listen to the other side. On page 7 in paragraph B, we quote about what is the eternal struggle of life. This taken from the Talmud in tractate Brachos 61a. Shimon ben Pazi said, man was created, it's hinted at in the creation story, with woes. There's always either the woe is me because of my creator, if I listen to my evil inclination, woe is me because of my evil inclination. Because if I listen to the evil inclination, I have pangs of conscience. If I listen to my conscience, my evil inclination always bothers me. Because you're always bothered one way or another. You never go off scot-free. And the final analysis, if you're going to be bothered anyway, you might as well be left with your dignity and your values rather than have sacrificed them and have these feelings of worthlessness and depression. S is sin. We're going to go back over all of this again. I is industry. We spoke about envy. We spoke about the disappointments of life. I wish I was this, or I wish I had this opportunity or that opportunity. We just touched upon the idea of an afterlife. It's important to know, what is the Torah's view about life in general? And this is the last paragraph on page 7. Rabbi Tarfon said, this is taken from Ovos in chapter 2. This is section 15 and 16. It's worthwhile to quote the entirety. The day is short. There's much work to be performed. The workmen are lazy, but the reward is great. And the master of our house is insistent. In other words, we're here on life to accomplish great things. And we are all God's employees. He used to say, Rabbi Tarfon, it is not incumbent upon you to finish the work, but neither are you a free man to refrain therefrom. If you studied much Torah, they will give you much reward. Your employer can be trusted to pay you the rewards of your labor. You should know, however, that the true reward granted to the righteous is in the world to come. That really sums up, in a nutshell, the Jewish view of life. We're passing through life. There are many joys in life, but the joys of life probably are compared really to the joys of your office. If you have an office and you have piped in music and beautiful furniture and paintings and mirrors, and there's a wonderful ambiance, but if you look that there are no customers or clients or patients coming to your office, you don't look at yourself as a great success. No matter what the furnishings and the beauty of your office is. On the other hand, if your office is very plain and the ambiance is poor and it's filled with customers, you look at yourself as a success. It's very pleasant to have a beautiful office, but it's more important to have a successful business. Every one of us is in the business of improving ourselves and the world about us. That's what we're here on earth. That's our business. It's very nice to have a wonderful ambiance. It's a wonderful that our offices should be well furnished. But if they are or they're not, our measure of success in life is what we put into it, and not the ambiance. So again, the I is for industry. We should know, that how we measure ourselves is not ultimately how much pleasures we got out of life, but what kind of good we produced in life. On page 8, the B is many of the problems that we have, as we say, industry is part of life, overwork is no good. I don't know if any of you still remember Maynard G. Krebs. Overwork, to the sense that you're a workaholic, that you never stop to think, is really one of the greatest stumbling blocks that we have to grow as people. It's important to work, to have the sense of growth and direction. But we shouldn't do it, I mean, we shouldn't overdo it. And again, it says, after a whole life, and all you've done is just worked, and not the work that comes with changing your character or helping other people, but just work putting bread on the table, or work making money for the next vacation. When all this work ends and you retire, there's very often a very empty feeling. What did you do with all those years? Which takes us now to O of depression, which is old age. And it's very important to realize, from a Jewish point of view, it's never too late. As long as there's life, there's hope. And you're never too old to learn. And old age really can be a tremendous opportunity. But it's an opportunity you have to seize. Because otherwise, you just continue on doing the same things you've done your whole life, and the emptiness continues. And there's so many opportunities you can do when you don't have the burdens of overwork. My mother, Aleha Sholom, was in the nursing home for the last years of her life. It was so wonderful to see the volunteers come in to help these women, to feed them, to talk to them, to be involved in activities. You can mean so much in other people's lives now that your time is free. I know of one man, and of several, they were retired school teachers, that spend their time now tutoring, volunteering in schools to give children the advantages they can't have because they can't afford special tutoring. And the classrooms are set up in such a way that they can't benefit from the situation of being taught in mass. There's a wonderful story, really, that probably really tells what encapsulates the Jewish view of old age. We quoted from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky earlier in the evening. He was once on a plane with his grandchild, and his grandchild, of course, treated him with the greatest respect and made sure he had what to eat and he was comfortable. And there was an elderly man in another seat who was watching all of this. I don't know if he was Jewish or not, but a person whose orientation was much more secular. And he marveled at the respect that his grandchild, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's grandchild, gave him, in contrast to that with the disrespect or lack of respect that this man's grandchild treated this man. And he asked the rabbi, says, what's the secret? Says, why is it, says, that you know that your grandchild gives you so much respect and mine doesn't? And the rabbi replied, says, you know, we Jews believe, says, that the greatest moment in our history was at the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. The Jews were, during their history from Sinai and on, were people who were involved in spirituality. And generation after generation, as they get further from Sinai and further from that peak experience, somehow, by the fact that they are removed, are less touched, are less spiritual, less whole. As a grandfather, as a person who knew people from the past generation. My grandson senses I have something since he will never have. I'm closer to the traditions, to the knowledge, to the spirit that goes back so many thousands of years. I can bridge with my grandchild a glorious past. You, on the other hand, your whole view is that of progress. Man is merely, says, an intelligent ape. And as history progresses, man becomes wiser and greater and more spiritual. Hence, you who are old-fashioned have very little to give to your grandchild who's progressing. My grandson looks up to me, whereas your grandson looks as that he is the next link in the evolutionary chain, and you are closer to the ape than he. That was the answer that he gave. The idea, though, really goes to the very core of what it is to be a Bobi and a Zaidi. So we can bridge the gap of our Bobis and Zaidis. We come from thousands of years of history, of experiences our grandchildren will never know. Our children may never know. And it's this sense of continuous history that as long as we are alive, we can give to the next generation. But the N is for neighbors. It's been said, I don't want to say who said it, that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it takes a community to raise a healthy individual. To become healthy, it's important to be part of a community. A community of sensitive individuals. Maybe it's suburbia. It's maybe the fact is we don't live in communities. We live in subdivisions. And there's so few sidewalks. No one walks together in the streets. We just drive. And we only meet each other in the malls. But it used to be there's a sense of community. In my neighborhood, at least in the weekdays, it's not so. But at least when it comes to Shabbos, I mean, the streets are filled. There's a sense of you're part of a community. And that's why it's so important to belong to something. And especially you're belonging to people who are involved in a cause, in a higher cause, that the whole nature of the people that are belonging are people of sensitivity. As we quote here from the Talmud, one of the opinions has it, when you have problems, and we all have problems, it's important to have a close friend, at least to speak over those problems. Not just for the catharsis, but for the advice, and maybe for the prayers. Again, let me just recap what we went through this evening. Depression. We discussed D of depression is that really it's a mitzvah in Torah not to be depressed. One should live a life of moderation, as the Rambam says, should always be happy. And especially when it comes to doing mitzvahs, doing the right thing. Our life should be a life of joy. We discussed the idea of the sickness of depression, not just the mood of depression. And we went through the alphabet A through M. And if a person has the majority of those symptoms, the loss of appetite and disturbed sleep and spontaneous crying, it's important to get medical attention. On the other hand, in terms of just a mood, it's important to change one's outlook on life and to create an atmosphere that creates simcha, joy. We expound on two artificial things that create joy, E, exercise, P, pleasure. We discussed R as religion. In terms of a religious outlook, create a much more wholesome outlook. We discussed E, what the causes of depression, envy, we discussed sadness, that sometimes it is important to be sad. But on the other hand, it should come, it should go, we should have the catharsis and get it behind us. Says S is sin. There's nothing more that causes depression. We don't have our self-respect because we keep on compromising our own values. I, industry, the importance to have a sense of purpose in life. O, old age, the idea that we are a link to the generations past. And we can, as we're growing older, if we take it to heart, this is grow wiser and have greater opportunities to impact on life about us. And N is neighbors. I'd like to conclude with the following story. As we said before, we all have challenges in life. But the important thing in life is to get those, to take hold of those challenges. Not to be the victim, but be the victor. And in essence, to summarize the Jewish view of how we deal with these challenges in life, I'd like to tell over the following story. It was told over to me by the former chief rabbi of the British Empire, says Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobovitz. As the story goes, it's a joke, says there were three people who were diagnosed by the same doctor having an incurable illness, and they were only given 3 months to live. One was an Irishman, one was a Frenchman, and one was a Jew. The media somehow got hold of this story and decided to interview these unfortunate patients. They interviewed the Irishman and they asked him, says, what are your plans for the next 3 months? He said, oh, these are going to be a very busy 3 months. He said, what are you planning? You know, I scrimped and saved all my life. I was waiting for my retirement. Now there's no retirement. I only have 3 months to live. I'm going to spend it all and enjoy life. He went to the Frenchman, asked the Frenchman, what are your plans? Oh, it's going to be a very busy 3 months. For a Frenchman, I was very straight-laced. But now, says, there's no reason. I have 3 months to live. I'm going to enjoy life to its fullest. And then they interviewed the Jewish patient. And they asked him, says, what are your plans? Oh, it's going to be a very busy 3 months. He says, really? Says, what are you planning on doing? I'm going to be looking for another doctor. Says, we don't give up. Okay, are there any questions? The question was asked, says, Jews are being killed by terrorists in Israel, relatives or non-relatives. How does one cope with the sense of depression? The question is a very basic one. Let me just give a few thoughts to this. First of all, It's very interesting. In a traditional house of mourning, the prayer that is said upon leaving is Hamokim Yenachem Eschem. Let the place means let God, says, give you consolation. B'soich Shar Avele Tzion V'Yerushalayim, amongst all the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. All the Jewish people are mourning. It's a mourning which has lasted over 2,000 years. But in a certain sense, there's room to be depressed. You know, it's not, in other words, depressed in terms of sadness. It is, there's, you know, on one hand, one can argue, says that there's, we have what to be sad about. We just went through in the last generation, the Holocaust in Europe destroyed almost all of European Jewry. Most of us have some relatives, of close or distant relatives, who died in that Churban, that terrible destruction. We have what to be sad. I mean, I don't want to minimize that. On another aspect of this, there is a passage of the Talmud that refers to things that are hidden from all of mankind, things that we don't know the answers. One of them is, when are we going to be consoled? There are situations, traumatic situations of death in the family, and we know, when are we ever going to get over this? And the answer, the Talmud says, we don't know. We pray to God, and only God knows when we will get over this. But I don't want to give a glib answer and saying, well, it's nothing. It is something. And there is definitely something that there's what to be sad. I mean, there's something very much to be sad about. It used to be a common thing amongst Jews, at least great Jews, that they used to get up at midnight, every night, to say special prayers about the Tikkun Chatzos, special prayers about the fate of the Jewish people, about Jerusalem and Israel and the exile and the fate of the Jewish people. It was something very dear to their heart. One of the great rabbis of Europe in the early 1800s was Moshe Teitelbaum, who founded the Hasidic dynasty of Siget and Satmar. He was named by the book that he wrote, the Yismach Moshe. He was not a chassid, at least originally. He was not a chassid. He was not part of the Hasidic movement. He eventually became close, though, to one of the Hasidic giants of his generation. Says Yaakov, says Yisrael Horowitz, called the Choza, the seer, the psychic of Lublin. And he had this Moshe Teitelbaum had all kinds of reservations about the Hasidic movement. And one of his reservations was, is how could you Hasidim, because joy was a big stress amongst Hasidim, how could you always be happy when there's so much suffering going around in the world? How could you be happy when the Jews are in such a state of misery? And the Chose of Lublin replied, it's very interesting, his reply. He said, you know, I also get up every midnight and say Tikkun Chatzos, and say the prayers, the midnight prayers. And when I say them, I cry. And in the midst of my tears, I am in the height of ecstasy and simcha. And let me explain you why. And he told him with a little story, a cute little story, about a king who had a close friend, a commoner. And they were very close, and the commoner left the kingdom and went to seek his fortune in another country. Some years later, the commoner received a letter from his friend, the king. The king wrote to the commoner, his friend, that he had fallen on hard times. There was a revolution in his kingdom. He had been thrown out. He was forced to wander. And the only person that he felt close enough to unburden himself was his friend, this commoner. And that's why he's writing the letter and detailed all the tzoros, all the problems that happened to him. When the commoner, the friend, read this letter, he had mixed emotions. On one hand, he felt terrible for his friend, the king, who had fallen from such from such heights to such depths. On the other hand, he was in the height of simcha that at least through all of this, his friend was still so close to him, his king, that he felt he of all people was the one that he felt close enough to write a letter to. It's possible, says, to have mixed emotions. He says, I cry, says, for the destruction of the Jewish people, for the temple, for Israel. On the other hand, I'm full of joy that at least I have the sensitivity to feel the pain. A person who's totally paralyzed, says, is totally numb, can't feel pain. I feel happy that at least I have enough sensitivity and I feel close enough and I'm advanced enough that I could feel the pain. And how paradoxical it is, how ironic it is, but at the same time we could feel the pain and we could feel the joy. That's one part of this. And the other part of this, and again, not underestimating the sorrow, is this story that I set over with the three dots on the wall. So instead of three dots, make them 20 dots, or 30 dots, or 50 dots. But we have a whole white wall. It says, Baruch Hashem, despite all the tzoros that we may have, and we should not forget those tzoros, but we have so much to be thankful for. If it's our families, it's our health, it's our sensitivity, it's the childhood that we had, it's the fine people that we have, we were privileged to know in our lifetimes. And it's possible for us to hold diverse emotions at one time. It's not that we have to permanently have a smiles fixed to our face, but as the Rambam says, our general demeanor should be happy. Okay. One more question? Okay.
Well, as you said, religion is saying it's so important and happy. So what could you do as a friend of someone who's depressed, who has no faith in God, and they're very detached from their Jewish roots?
We probably, the question about, as we were outlining before, that one of the keys to overcoming depression is an outlook of religion and faith. We're blessed in this community. I mean, that there are resources. There are people that you can contact. There are institutions. There's Machon LaTorah and Eish HaTorah and Or Sameach. There are many different institutions in this community, and I'm not exhausting them. That it's worthwhile you as a friend to contact, to know if the chemistry is right, because it's like a shidduch, it's matchmaking, to arrange a meeting, with someone. And it could be that a meeting, if the chemistry is there, could have, the meeting itself could have a positive effect. Meeting someone who is religious and has a spiritual view of life can very often be infectious. So I think the first step would really be to contact one of those, one of those people that you feel is a good chance of touching this person, and then, as a matchmaker, arranging the shidduch.
Rabbi, would you agree that depression isn't all bad? Because sometimes when a person goes through a stage of depression, it's because of certain acts or problems in his life that he has to face and overcome to grow. And maybe God puts these obstacles in our way to help us grow. Maybe it goes to certain basic questions that God created both good and evil, and there's a reason for having both.
The question about the depression can play a very important role, because it very often makes us come to grips with the problems that created the depression. It's really like the story that I said about the wake-up call. It's about the motorcyclist, the biker who fell off the cliff and got the wake-up call. And it's true, like many of the experiences we have in life, going through this depression can be very helpful, because at least it makes us aware of our problems. those who are involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the whole approach of Alcoholics Anonymous is a very spiritual one. You put your life in God's hands. Realize that those people generally don't go for help unless they've like hit rock bottom and realize that they really need help. They really have to be shook up bad. And very often it's true that, having the experience is very beneficial. But it's only beneficial if we learn from that experience and go on from that experience and live a life which really should be the ideal kind of a life. But the experience as a whole could be very beneficial, you know, if it's only temporary. Okay, good night.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.